Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Elaine Lindsay. Elaine Lindsay, oak cartographer and shadow alchemist known as the Dark Pollyanna, navigates the fault lines between despair and resilience, distilling truth from trauma and weaving raw emotional landscapes into language. She maps the brutal beauty of survival, offering others a compass made of candor, contradiction, and sparks that refuse to die. Not here to fix, here to witness, reflect, and remind you that staying is its own kind of sacred work. She walks the fault lines with ink-stained hands, sketching hope where the sky cracked. Elaine, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been looking forward to our conversation for quite a while now.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dave. I, too, am very excited to be here with you today.
And I think we met through a fellow podcaster. It might have been John Emery, who's got the Podcasters Hub.
Definitely John.
Yeah. Because I remembered when I did my first post on his page, he recommended a couple of individuals who would be good guests for the podcast. And you're one of the names that he mentioned. I think we connected from there, had a conversation, and voila, here we are today.
Yeah, absolutely. John, a little shout out there. John is absolutely lovely. He and I have actually met in person. We went to PodFest together a couple of years ago, and I got to meet his kids too, which was really nice.
Yeah, and I know you also did a presentation at the Podcasters Hub as well for him.
Yeah. That's one of my other hats.
Yes. Yeah, among the many that you wear. So, and I know we're going to get into all of that with podcasting and your own journey. And I'm just looking forward to taking a deep dive into who you are. So whenever you're ready, we'll get going.
Well, thank you. You want me to just dive in?
Dive in and tell the audience about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions that have made you the Dark Pollyanna.
Yeah. The good thing is I've got a way to sort of give you the sound bite, and then we can go back and unpack stuff. Mm-hmm. So let's put it this way. I've died three times. The first time I was alone and pregnant, and then twice more on an operating table. I buried my child, most of my family, and my dearest friends, and suffered multiple miscarriages. Yet I remain unbroken. Malpractice left me surviving three botched surgeries, two clinical deaths. And for 7 months, I had my esophagus diverted out my neck. Yes, you heard that right. After the surgeon slit my throat. Life has definitely, shall we say, been interesting. When you feed through a tube in your side for over a year, you get some funny stories. We'll talk about those too. So you see, as much as it sounds all really yucky, there's a lot of humor in what happens in our lives. And for me, the greatest gift in the world is to be able to laugh at yourself and take that humor, because that humor can be the very best medicine in the world.
Yeah, I was talking to another podcast guest contributor, we were talking about the role that humor tends to play, especially during the darkest moments of our lives. And for 27 years, I was an addictions counselor and a clinical supervisor, and humor got me through a lot of really tough moments and working with very challenging individuals with really challenging histories. And I'll tell you, Elaine, if I took everything as seriously as I could have taken, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking with you today.
Well, yeah, if you take life too serious, first of all, I wouldn't be here in front of you. I wouldn't be here at all, let's be quite frank. I live with suicidal ideation my entire life. So I definitely guarantee I would not be here. The humor is divine given. I believe if we allow it, the universe provides. Viktor Frankl said it best. You know, bottom line is we have choice. No one can take that away from us.
Yes.
You can choose to wallow in your garbage. And there are days where that's the only thing I can do. Mm-hmm. But there's always a time limit. You have to allow yourself the bad days as well as the good days. But for me, I think the most important thing is, even on those days, I always find something to laugh at or with, sometimes both. It can be very difficult to live in pain 24/7. And you were an addictions counselor, so you understand. I call myself a functional junkie because I am still reliant on morphine. It's a very minimal 15 milligram dose a day. It's long acting that I only take at night. And that's down from hundreds of milligrams a day. So I'm pretty proud of that. And it took a long time for me to come to terms with the fact that I was going to have to stay on the morphine in order to keep going. But it's amazing what we learn as we get older. I say I'm a slow learner. Here I am at 70 years of age, finally, I think, almost totally getting it.
Yeah, and I'm the same age as you are at this point. I'm still learning. There's still some parts of life that I haven't quite gotten yet. But as long as I have my students to keep me honest, and as long as I'm open to continuing to grow, I'm going to figure out more stuff before I start dancing in another dimension. But it's an ongoing process, Elaine. Growth doesn't stop because we reach a particular age.
Oh, God, no. I think somebody said the other day, she too is in her 70s now, and she said, this is the decade of you can say and do anything because you've gone through all the self-doubt and the self-involvement and all of those stages that we go through. And in your 70s, I'm really looking forward to being able to learn things I really want to learn, things that are no longer sort of an accident of what's going on or something that I've fallen into because of some faux pas I made, which is very often. Oh, it's a chance to explore where you're not as self-conscious or as self-effacing as you used to be in some of the other decades. And that's only something I've come to understand maybe in the past year, year and a half, which is very freeing, you know?
We buy into the fact that after a certain age, we stop growing. We buy into the whole ageistic philosophy that Western society has. I refuse to buy into that. So I'm going to continue to challenge myself. I'm going to continue to reinvent myself. I'm going to continue to grow as much as possible until I'm not allowed to grow anymore. And that will be the day that I leave this planet.
I'm totally with you there. And I've seen over the years, people who go into retirement as a new chapter where they have plans to do things, they do well. Mm-hmm. People who retire like they're retreating from life seem to just wither and die.
Yeah.
It's like you plant a rose bush and the rose bush decides after 5 years, okay, I was beautiful, that's quite enough. Well, it'll be dead in no time. Things are meant to go through their cycles and flourish. Yeah. I don't think we were ever meant to give up. retirement to me is, well, why would I stop learning? Why would I stop questing to figure things out? That just doesn't make sense.
Well, and besides, I think, Elaine, the more we stay engaged, the longer we live.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I believe research has borne that out. And the other thing is that for me, Native Americans have this philosophy where there's four seasons of life. And it's the elder's responsibility to take the lessons from the first three seasons and pass those on to the younger generation. So as elders, I think we have a tremendous responsibility to really prepare the younger generation for what's to come, to have them learn from our mistakes, our missteps, but also just to have them learn from us who've lived seven decades. And if we just retire and say, okay, I can stop doing what I was doing and I can stop existing, we're going to wither up like that rosebush. We're going to wither up and die. And particularly with the losses that you've experienced and the tragedies you've experienced, the tragedies that I've experienced, I would be remiss if I couldn't share that knowledge with anybody who wants to say, no, how do you transcend tragedy? How do you handle the challenges in your life? I'm cheating not only myself, but I'm cheating anybody who wants that information.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact is, I believe we went through these things to be able to share the lessons we learned and perhaps the tools that we found to help us cope. When I lost my friend at 16 to suicide, I did not cope. I did not manage well at all. I learned to drink and do drugs and do anything so I wouldn't have to feel. And for 4 years, that was kind of how I bumbled through life, not realizing I'd actually retreated to be about 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed that way for decades. And then by the time I was 20 years old, my second daughter died the day she was born. And a year later, I was pregnant again. I had a multiple vehicle accident. I was crushed between three cars on a highway in the middle of the night. I had gone out to help someone that I probably shouldn't have. And in that instant, I not only lost my child, I lost half my leg. I was hospitalized for the first time for 5 months. And then it became a constant for the next 5 years. You don't have a lot of time to grow or to learn or to do anything when by the time you're 20, you're in the bubble of horrific pain. And trust me, pain does not necessarily make you a good person. I've said for years now, in my 20s, I was a raving bitch. I was so defensive and so get them before they get me because I was so self-conscious about having lost my leg. I think I'm incredibly lucky. I look back and think, what are you complaining about? I lost my leg vertically. So it was this way, not across. I still have a foot and a leg. I needed plastic surgery. I'm missing bones and lymph and all of those things. But I can still stand. I'm not the prettiest walker you're ever going to see, but I can walk. Okay? That's a real bonus. And in my 20s, I didn't take the time. Because of what was coming at me and everything else that was going on, I never gave myself any grace. I never took the time to acknowledge the gift that was me living through that. You know, I was hit at 50 miles an hour and I was thrown 2.5 lanes across the highway. I wasn't in the vehicle at the time. I was standing between two vehicles. When a third vehicle hit, that's a hell of an accident to have to live through.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the things that later, in hindsight, I can say, good Lord, I was so lucky. And more so that finally, I took the lessons and learned And I think it's given me more empathy for others. Not on a little level. I found the humor. In my 20s, the humor was dark. And it was real gallows. And I always, it was like having to get them before they got me. Mm-hmm. So I called myself a gimp. I made a point of always talking about my no knees. I lost both kneecaps. I have no cartilage and this big hole in my leg. My father told me to tell people I got bit by a shark because it's a better story. And he was absolutely right. I come by the humor naturally.
Mm-hmm. I could say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Not at all. In hindsight, a lot of what happened later, dying in surgery, I chose to have that surgery. So in essence, you know, I am partly at fault. But all of that to say, I had a part to play in everything that went on in my life. Mm. And a part to finally choose, well, do I sit in the corner and cry my face off? Or do I live? And I think I'm pretty blessed. I have two children. I have a husband of decades who's wonderful and puts up with all of my whining because I'm much more likely to whine at him than I am outside. But I have learned to do what I can with what I have. I've done stand-up comedy in clubs. I did it at PodFest last year. I have done things that I never thought I could have. Because when Andrea died at 16, it was the clash of symbols that absolutely rocked my world like nothing else. I had lived with this ideation as a kid. I saw Pollyanna when I was 6 years old, and it became this yin-yang. Pollyanna took over, then ideation took over, and it went back and forth. But when Andrea died, for me, it was a brutal awakening that this is what ideation meant. This was a no coming back from. This was not a game that I could allow my body to play with me. This meant the end. And there were definitely attempts. There were times where they pumped my stomach and I was hospitalized. And I have no idea how people found me or what have you. But the sad thing is, I'm a hell of an actress. So you don't get caught when you're an actress. You can talk your way out of damn near anything. And as much as there is a sinister pride, I even hear in my voice when I say that, it's not a good thing. And I know that now. I know that was dangerous. It served me well in my 20s. And the car accident and everything I said so far wasn't the bad stuff that happened.
And in fact, I think we were talking during our pre-chat conversation about, yeah, I think you had mentioned that Andrea's death and your second car accident was actually pretty transformative for you, if I recall correctly. Can you elaborate a little more on what changed for you? What transformed as a result of those events?
Well, it's actually the whole space in there, Dave. The second accident didn't happen until 1997.
Okay.
But what happened when I was 27? When I was young, when Andrea died, I was a figure skater. I rode horses. I skied. I rode a bike every day of the summer for miles and miles and miles. I was so active constantly. And then I had the accident. And I didn't have two working legs anymore. I was in casts for 5 years, one leg or the other. Again, the goofy me would take over, and I'd run into somebody, and I'd have a cast on my right leg, I'd see them again in 2 months, and I'd have a cast on my left leg. They'd go, oh, I thought that was on your other leg. No, no, you're wrong. And that would go on for years. Little bizarre thing would continue to happen. And over time, by the time I was 27, I had put on an awful lot of weight that just horrified me. I hated me with such a deep passion. I was weak. I gained weight. I was missing part of my leg. I was disgusting. I had all these scars. Those are the words that ran through my head constantly. And it just made me nasty. It made me mean. And it made me so sad that what had happened to the person I was. I was, you know, I was stuck in victim state, definitely. I saw Oprah, and she was talking to someone who was doing a vertical banded gastroplasty. It was a forerunner to what they call bariatric surgery now. It was one of the first. And as soon as I heard it, I thought, that'll give me the opportunity to get a head start on what I need to do. And so I told my family what I wanted to do. And they told me I was nuts. And they said, no, this can't happen. And whether you call it the divine or God or the universe or what have you, we get confirmation of what we want always. Whether it's good or bad doesn't matter. If you are looking for confirmation, you will get it. And so my son was just very young. We had gone with the family for brunch on Sunday to our favorite place. I had gone into the bathroom, and a woman came behind me at the sink. And I looked up, and she looked in the mirror, and she said, oh my God, you are so beautiful. Why are you fat? And that, for me, was exactly what I'd been waiting for. I had asked the universe, tell me that I am right. I am disgusting. Everything about me, blah, blah. That was Sunday. Monday morning, I called the doctor and said, get me an appointment with the doctor that's doing this surgery. And I fought with my family for the rest of that year. I jumped through all the hoops. I took the psychological tests. I did everything I was supposed to do. I actually lost 30 pounds before I went for the surgery. It was booked for the beginning of September 1983. I had one trip to Vegas in June with the company I worked for because I had outsold everyone. I had a group. I was a manager of a group of women. It was a really good cosmetics company out of California. I had done everything that I could do, not realizing my weight had nothing to do with it. Okay, nobody didn't buy from me because I was fat. I mean, it was all in my head. However, by the time I went into the hospital, I had set up daycare for the kids. I was supposed to be gone 3 weeks. I could go back to work after 3 weeks. I'd be in the hospital for a week. I would feed through a tube in my side for 3 weeks. And when that was done, they would take it out and I would go back to work and everything would be great. And when I got into the hospital, the first thing they tried to do was put in what they call a central line. And it goes between the collarbone and the chest bone. I should have had some foreshadowing because as it turns out, 1 in 600,000 people have a condition where the two bones are so close together, you have a hard time reaching the vein. So it took them a really long time to start that IV. I went to surgery the next morning. The doctor was, I assume, pleased with what I had done up to that point. He knew how committed I was to doing this. And I'll never know what actually happened in that surgery because he fudged the OR reports. There were, I believe, 3 for that first one. We don't know which one is actually real. He didn't tell us that something went wrong in that surgery, but it led to a gastric leak. I don't know anything about gastric leaks. And in 1983, you were considered really rude if you asked a doctor anything. You didn't talk that. It was really important that you said nothing. Yep. A week went by and I had this weird pain in my left shoulder. And I thought, oh, I'll just keep it quiet. But they couldn't get rid of my fever. And he came and said, well, we'll send you home over the weekend, as long as you come back on Tuesday for this special swallow to check on things. Yep, no problem. I'll do it, I'm told. Absolutely. But I felt that I needed to do some penance because my family did not want me to do this. So I went home with nothing for pain. I didn't even last 17 hours. I couldn't sit, I couldn't stand, I couldn't lie down, and I couldn't have anything by mouth. So to get something for pain, it had to go through the tube in my side, which meant we had to go to emergency. When we went to emergency, my husband called, and back then this was an experimental surgery. So the other doctors weren't even sure what to say or what to do. When we got to emerge, the doctor said it was very obvious I was in a lot of pain. I had a high fever. Wasn't quite sure why that was happening. And he gave me a shot and wrote a prescription for my husband to go get the next morning. And as I'm getting ready, he shut the curtain and said, go ahead, get dressed. You can go home. And as he shut the curtain, the resident that was in my surgery came walking through emergency. My husband, who was just sitting outside the curtain area, he wasn't sure what was going on. He didn't know anything. He just knew the look on this man's face terrified him. Something was horribly wrong. The next thing he knew, he's being told that I can't leave. And I'm being put on a gurney and being rushed to the x-ray department. They're doing a swallow. And they're talking about surgery, and it's now midnight. The head of the x-ray department had come in and was trying to explain to me that I had a gastric leak. The surgeon came in and came up and smirked at me and said, go ahead. Come on, tell us what you ate or drank. Are you crazy? And everybody was aghast that I dare talk to the doctor. So I went against my entire family. I have put my whole life on hold to do this. Why on earth would I jeopardize that? Mm-hmm. I got no answer. I now know all these years later, that's called gaslighting.
Yeah.
What that led to was surgery number 2. Again, I'm going to sing the chorus for you. We'll never know what actually happened in that surgery because I think there was only 2 reports for this one. Neither of them made any sense. There's something in our body called omentum, and it's like the glue inside the body. So when they operate on you, they will sometimes wrap the omentum around the scar to allow it to heal. It just makes it a little tighter. I'm beginning to think in that second surgery, he didn't take it down to check where he had manually sutured. He had been using something called a trocar to cut the holes in the stomach and something malfired or missed, I don't know. And he had done some manual sutures, but he never tested them. So rather than take the omentum down, we think he just looked at that pouch and left it. What he didn't see by not going right down was it was percolating infection. And the fever just kept getting higher. 2 days after the second surgery, my lung collapsed and I developed an abscess. and they had my husband hold me over the tray table on the bed so that they could cut a hole in my side to put in a chest tube to help me breathe. It got worse and worse every day. They were giving me blood transfusions because I was losing a great deal of blood. I was bleeding internally. On the, I guess, sixth day, I think that's when everything burst open. I developed peritonitis. I went septic. And they rushed me into x-ray again. They couldn't do the swallow like they used to because there was so much chance that everything was just swimming in me. The doctor came out after and said, "We have to take you back to surgery now." And I said, "Thank you, no, I'm done. I just, yeah, no, just sign me out. I want to go home." I couldn't even stand up, but I was bound and determined. Enough. You've poked me, you've cut me, you've done all this. No, no, I'm just done. And I had the nurse bring me a phone, and I phoned my dad and I phoned my husband. And I said, "If either of you sign this consent form, I will never talk to you again." My dad said later, "I wouldn't have spoken to anybody again because I was dying." And they told my family that they had until maybe noon before I was dead. So the family signed. They took me back into surgery. We found out 11 years later in court that my heart stopped. I died. And the reaction of the surgeon when I died was to start undoing everything he'd done. You see, he was trying to cover his tracks.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know this, but he had been investigated because he'd already killed two people in the cohort of 37, of which I was one. 37 people with all that he had done, and two of them were already dead. The young residents and the other surgeons that were in the OR managed to get me back. And after I stopped breathing again, he went back to taking things apart, which meant he was making the tissue what they call friable.
Mm-hmm.
So when I very unceremoniously got breathing again, I know he was not happy. The other surgeon said, "Like, you have to fix. You got to close her up." And his response was to bring in another surgeon and have him slit my throat and divert my esophagus out my neck. He wanted no secretions to get to the stomach, I guess, to try and let it heal. But I don't know why. I'm not a doctor. I know the saliva is like battery acid.
Yeah.
And if you just let saliva bubble over someone's skin for days, it eats your skin. You blister and bubble and becomes open. It's not pretty. I spent 11 days in ICU. When I came to in the room, they were having trouble because there weren't enough hookups on the walls for all the tubes that were coming out of me. They had to put three machines on what they call gravity suction, and they were just standing on the floor. I woke up with a tube coming out of my neck, and I had tubes all over me. I had things that looked like hand grenades. They're called Jackson Pratt drains, and they were all over. And then I had this big tube on my right side. I talk about him because he went home with me for 7.5 months, as well as everything else. But I called him Hugo because you go where I go. And he did.
I like that.
Thank you. Yeah, I liked Hugo until he was mean to me and he let the doctor know that I'd been sneaking popsicles, but that's a whole other thing. All of this to say, they had to leave me open from stem to stern because they couldn't put me back together. All of the tissue was too friable to reconnect. So I was packed and unpacked 3 to 5 times a day while they tried to get me to heal from the inside. And that went on for months. I went back to a ward after the 11 days in ICU, and the nurses were wonderful. They would start at night after the guests left. They would bring towels and stuff them around my neck, and then they'd let me have half a popsicle. And it was messy, awful, but oh my God, it was so good. Because now this was almost the end of October. I had had nothing by mouth since the 12th of September. And I was so thirsty. Now, don't get me wrong. I was feeding through the tube in my side. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really thirsty. But if you don't let somebody have something by mouth, that's all you can think about. It's crazy. All of my skin was so badly blistered and broken. One of the nurses came in, and it had been about 2 weeks after I'd gone to a floor. I have an idea. We're going to get this lady. She's a stoma therapist. And I don't know what that is. She said, they deal with, you know what a colostomy bag is? I said, yeah. Yeah, I know what a colostomy is. Okay, well, she's going to teach you how to use one on your neck. Like, what? She says, it will catch, sorry to be gross, but catch the saliva so it stops eating your skin. Mm-hmm. And that should give you a chance to heal, at least there. And so that's exactly what they did. And they came off every 2 to 3 days, but it made a big difference. Unfortunately, I wore that for 7 months. I finally went home for Christmas. My mother and father wanted to be kind and put some turkey and gravy in the blender so that I could have some in the bag, and said, no, we're not making the rest of the family sick. That's awful.
No.
I was just happy to be there. But I do have to say, this clear plastic bag around my neck, that is a bitch to accessorize. Nothing goes with clear plastic. Gross. Anyway.
Yeah, I would find it difficult to accessorize too. With the clear plastic bag. It's like, what shirt do I wear? What shoes match with it? What fedora is going to go with? those kind of decisions would be.
Oh, fascinator, not a fedora. Got to have a fascinator.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to get some fashion tips from you.
There you go. The surgeon who had done that to my neck, it was not until March that he was able to somewhat put it together. My neck had been open for too long, and the scar tissue was built up, so I couldn't eat. I couldn't swallow. They had to do something called dilatation, and they did that for 10 months. Off and on. It's like big bullets. They put you to sleep and they put these bullets down your throat to try and stretch it out. I was still feeding through the tube in my side by that point. But the tube in the side, a feeding tube, has what they call a stopcock on it, so you can open it. And unfortunately, it's not really well placed. It's put in your small bowel, and it's tacked by a few stitches, but they fall out a lot. And here it gets real gross. The stuff that's in it falls out too.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of bile goes with this. It's not an attractive color, and I am not an autumn, so it does not suit me at all. I'll tell you one quick story. It had been almost a year, and my friend had her boyfriend come and get me so that he could see what was left of me. And it was a big deal that I was getting to go for a visit. And I got dressed up in a white French vanilla colored dress and a little white jacket and got into her her boyfriend's Mercedes that was beige. I'm saying all the colors for a reason. We drive to her place, and I get out, and he helps me to the door. And when I ring the bell, she opens the door. I open my jacket, go, ta-da! And the look on her face just made me recoil a step. She looked horrified. And I thought, oh my God. And I looked down. The stopcock had come out.
Oh,
the whole front of the dress was bile yellow. And sadly, Ralph's car covered in bile too.
Oh.
I don't think he's forgiven me for that.
Well, I hope he does. And forgiveness, to remind Ralph, forgiveness is more for himself than it is for anybody else.
Good point. But again, I've got a funny story to tell people. Some people, the first time they hear it, don't find it quite as funny as I do. After you hear it once or twice, it is pretty funny.
I've always had a dark sense of humor because of dealing with my own experiences in my life and with the profession that I had. I had to have it to survive. So you tell me that kind of a story, I would have smiled because, I mean, to me, that would be the ultimate form of irony. You know, you get into a guy's brand new Mercedes and all of a sudden he's got to get a new paint job to match the yellow bile in the interior. So for me, that would be
leather.
Yeah.
His beige leather interior.
Ooh.
It did clean, thank God. It was a series of unfortunate incidents over time. Having those moments that we could laugh at.
Yes.
Made a lot of the rest possible. Because there was an awful lot of pain there. And the fact is, in that time, I don't walk well. I was losing more pieces of my legs. I had to have other things removed. And from what that doctor did, I developed osteoporosis, fell 18 inches and completely flattered my right arm. So I now have a great big titanium rod in my arm, which means bionic.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
Yes. And I have a half joint. My bad leg could only get a half joint, but it works really well, and I'm very grateful for that. It too is bionic, titanium. I have nails and screws and other bits and bobs here and there. And over the years, I know some people think maybe I'm going for the full bingo card, getting all the diseases one can possibly have. I will say I have a very healthy stomach. So I'm very excited about that. Everything else has kind of gone by the wayside. I have pancreatitis and cirrhosis of the liver from all the garbage that went on. I developed diabetes, so I'm insulin dependent. And the most recent is kidney failure. So we're dealing with that. Some of this is very challenging. And I had my last surgery last October. So it's not something you can put in the past if it won't stay there.
No. What happens in the past usually informs our present, whether we want it to or not.
Absolutely. Well, it is definitely informing a lot of the present.
It certainly is. And I have to ask you, because you've been through so much as far as with medical challenges, medical malpractice, loss. You know, the humor's been a big part of that. The dark humor's been a big part of that. Your ability to say, I have a choice to transcend this. But what else have you done to help you? You're still standing and you're thriving through everything. I mean, for those who are audience listening, they're probably asking, how is she doing it? So how are you doing it?
Fisher Price had something called weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. I am a survivor. But I'm beginning to believe that one day the earth will just be, and it'll just be me and the cockroaches, and I'm going to have to learn how to click so that I can converse with them because I love to chat. So when you don't have a choice in how you make things happen, you have to rely on the choice that you do have. I can sit in the corner and cry all day. God, that's boring. But if I take the time to find something funny, have a laugh with somebody, make somebody's day by saying hello or sending them a birthday wish. And I do this whenever I'm out, I say hello to everybody I see, because for some people that may be the only kind word they have, the only thing that day. Being mindful that what you give to others could be the one gift they get makes you much more aware. So I try, and I am not always successful. There are days where my poor husband puts up with whiny me, and I have what I call my wallow days.
Yep.
I allow myself to wallow. Boo-hoo, poor me, blah, 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 whatever. But there is a time limit.
Yes.
Because after a bit, you just have to dust off and, okay, let's get on with life. I don't like being bored. I don't like just doing nothing. That just doesn't make any sense to me. And the fact is, if you look around you, there is so much to be grateful for.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much to see and do and learn. You don't have to just be within yourself. It took me 3 or 4 years to learn to be grateful to me and for me that this old body has put up with everything that I've grown at, everything I've caused to happen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I am ever so grateful that it has, for the most part, stood the test of time. You know?
Yeah. I like the fact about wallowing in the bad days and wallowing those emotions, but not staying in there for too long, just enough to learn from it and move out from it and just survive through it. Maury Schwartz, the subject of Mitch Albom's book, Tuesdays with Maury, he had the same thing about his ALS. Yeah. He'd wake up, he'd cry, he'd be angry. He'd stay in that, but not for too long. He just said, I'd stay in it for a bit, detach, and then said, how am I going to live today? What am I going to do to live today? In reality, happiness isn't the only key to fulfillment. Being authentic and being in touch with everything that's part of the human experience. That includes our sadness. That includes our anger. That includes our disillusionment, our confusion, our bitterness. It's all got something for us. It's all got something to teach us, and it all contributes to our personal growth.
Absolutely. And something that I think is really simple. If you don't have a pet, then find a friend who does and just go. Let the dog kiss your face. Go pet your cat for 20 minutes. You cannot not value the sheer wonder of the world if you spend time with an animal.
Mm-hmm.
Or go smell some roses. Walk through the forest if you're that way inclined. Put me on a beach, I'm a happy, happy camper. I will walk on the beach for hours. Someone will have to come and take me back, but that's okay. I have a cane. It works. But the little thing, like, you know, pet. When I wake up in the morning, there's one that washes my face, and the other one comes just about within reach. She doesn't really like to be handled. But there's such love in these little critters. And it's such a gift to us. It's such a gift to us to be able to see and feel and enjoy that unconditional love.
Yeah.
Give yourself that gift.
Yeah.
Take 2 minutes and mindfully meditate. Be in the moment. Be mm-hmm. thankful that you're inside, you have a roof over your head. Okay, you're sitting in a chair, or you're standing next to your child or your grandchild, spouse, or your friends, or you know, for that matter, you're going to McDonald's drive-thru with some kids. That's something to be grateful for.
Yeah. Getting up every day and being able to take nourishment is something to be grateful for. And at
absolutely.
At my age, Elaine, I thank the good Lord, the universe, you know, for just allowing me to wake up, do what I enjoy doing. I think that there's a gift in getting older, because it's a privilege to get older.
Absolutely. It is a privilege, and it's a privilege to be able to pass on what you've learned.
Yeah.
Whether people take it or not, yeah, isn't the point. It's being able to share. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to offer things to people in that way. Offer it as something we're sharing, not something we're giving. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference there.
Yes.
I think that's the benefit of getting older, is understanding those fine differences. It's one thing to say, oh, when I was young, I did this or blah, blah, and don't do this, don't do that. That's not the point. I can share. I had a very difficult time as a teenager, and I did things I should not have.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sharing that with you, what you choose to do with it. I don't have control over.
That's right.
But I'm telling you the bad things that came from that, you decide. What is your choice?
Yeah. You know, I tell my students, with every behavioral choice we make, there's a consequence.
Oh, absolutely.
Make sure you choose those behaviors wisely. Make sure you choose the consequences wisely. And regardless of what happens, be accountable for anything that happens, yes, both good or bad.
Absolutely.
Both good or bad.
And you can't just pass stuff off on everybody else.
No.
When you hear people, when all they do is blame everyone else, I take accountability for choosing to have the surgery that maimed me.
Yeah.
Because it was my choice.
Yep.
I will say one thing. Had that doctor chosen to acknowledge his mistake and just told us what to look out for, all of this would not have happened. I would not be as sick as I am. I would not have had to go through all that I did, because we would have been watching for the symptoms of what was going on, and they would have caught it earlier.
Yeah.
So taking onus for what you do, good, bad, and indifferent, is incredibly important. And you also have to remember, sometimes you think you're doing something good. Not everybody takes it the way it's offered. Don't lose sight of the fact that your intentions were good. Just be willing to acknowledge it may not be received that way.
Yep.
And that's not reflective of you or them. It just is what it is.
And Don Miguel Ruiz, one of his four agreements in the book, the four agreements, is don't take things personally.
Yeah.
We plant seeds. We have no control how anybody's going to receive that. And we have to just chalk it up to individual differences, different belief systems. And just as we have free will to believe as we need to believe, they have free will to accept whatever and believe the way they believe. So it works both ways.
It took me the longest time to understand that having expectations of others is not the way to go.
No. I have enough difficulty having expectations for myself, much less having expectations for everybody else.
Absolutely.
I tell my wife, I have enough trouble minding my own business, much less anybody else's business.
Yeah.
That's enough energy just being me and minding me, much less worrying about what everybody else is doing. So, Elaine, one of my last questions for you today, I got a couple more questions to ask. I want to talk a little bit about your podcast, Suicide Zen and Forgiveness. I was a guest on your podcast, had a really wonderful experience. Tell our audience how the podcast evolved, how long it's been in existence, what you hope listeners take away from it.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. Suicide Zen Forgiveness actually began as Suicide Zombies and Forgiveness. But people didn't really understand the zombies. It came from a piece I had written. And we were attracting the wrong audience, which is how it changed to Zen. It's been running since 2018. From 2018 to 2021, it was kind of faltering because I started it after being invited to LinkedIn in Toronto. I had taken the train down for the day, and on the way there, I learned that Kate Spade had taken her life. I had been wrestling for decades with how to repay what my friend Andrea gave me, because in essence, she gave me a gift nobody wants. But the gift was to be one who knows what it is to be left behind. And that's how I managed to mess up a lot of attempts, so I'm still here. So I am grateful and so thankful to her for that. And the story of the zombie is from when my granddaughter was 12, we went to a zombie maze, and I found myself sacrificing my 12-year-old granddaughter, holding her literally in front of me because there was a zombie butcher coming towards me. Now, I am not a stupid person. I understand this was made up. He had a butcher knife in one hand, blood all over him. It was ketchup or whatever. My mind, our brains are so bizarre. All it knew was I needed to survive. And I put the one person that I love more than life itself right in front of me, the only grandchild I had. And she's going, "Grandma, what are you doing?" "I don't know." We got out of there and I thought, oh my God, what is wrong with me? And I thought I would never live it down. Well, in 2015, I was at an event that had run for all day, and someone asked me at lunch to hear about my story. I only started telling people in 2013, so it was still relatively new. And just before lunchtime, the main person putting on this event was talking, and all of a sudden, in my head, I was back at the accident. And the policeman handed me the cables because he didn't know how to use the booster cables. And I'm 5'2" and he was over 6 feet. And I'm standing between the cars with the hood up on my Mustang. And I can't see anything on the curve. And he saw the lights hit the curve. And he dove into the snowbank and saved himself. And I was crushed. And in that moment, seeing my granddaughter being pushed in front of me, I realized that man didn't save himself on purpose. His lizard brain took over, and he was just trying to survive. And in that moment, I forgave him. He had never come to the hospital in all the 5 months. The young man who actually hit both cars was there all the time. The sad thing is, everyone else in the accident, in my car, the guy that hit my car and the policeman, they're all dead. They've all been gone for a long time. And I'm still here, which is pretty incredible. So that's where suicide zombies came from. And the Zen came from the fact that I then learned how and why I should forgive him. And that became an incredible touchstone of understanding what the human mind is capable of, but more than that, how deep our survival instinct goes.
Yes.
And so the podcast was called Keep Breathing to Start. By 2021, a friend called me. I'm a digital integration specialist. I do optimization and integration with websites, social media, algorithms, and I've been working in machine learning now for 7 years, AI, all of that. That's what I do. Yet, 2021, I am talking at a weekend event. I went to a visioning board thing with a bunch of women and lawyers and all kinds of people who knew me and knew what I did. And at the end of the day, they went around and asked everybody what they took from the day and what was happening going forward. And wow, was I surprised. I got up and somebody else spoke in my head and said, "I'm finally going to take charge of what I need to be doing. I'm doing this podcast on suicide, and that's where my interest lies." I want to share people's stories because sharing your burden lightens it.
Yes.
And everyone in the room went, I'm sorry? Who are you? that's not who you are or what you do. And from that moment on, it did become exactly who I am and what I do. And I want to say one more thing, because this is kind of a first. There is a group in Britain called Baton of Hope. And they go around to 20 cities. They started 6 years ago. Two gentlemen who both lost their sons. And the Baton of Hope is passed from city to city for suicide prevention and awareness. I want to go one step further because I want us to look at life preservation. I want us to teach children that their thoughts, not all of them are real. Not all of them have to be acted on. And in fact, not all of the thoughts in your head are yours. And you have to be able to share them with others so that we can all know and keep each other safe. So on that note, 3 weeks ago, I've taken up the Baton of Hope for Canada. And we will be launching by December, getting ready for our city-to-city walk next year in October.
That's wonderful news and much needed awareness. It doesn't surprise me. That's an extension of the service work you're already doing through your podcast, through your presence, through your speaking engagements. And so if you diss me, I look at that as a good thing because you're a digital integration specialist. So if you diss me, then you're actually giving me some tools to help make my own podcast better.
Absolutely. And you know I'm all for that.
Yes. Yeah, you are.
More than happy to help.
Yeah, well, you've been very supportive of me as I've begun the podcast journey and given me some helpful hints and ideas. So I appreciate your presence. And Elaine, one more thing I got to ask you. How can people get in touch with you, follow your podcast, find out what you're doing, find out more about the Baton of Hope as that gets going? What's the best way for them to do that?
If you look up Elaine Lindsay or The Dark Pollyanna, or you can now look up the Baton of Hope Canada. We'll have that up very shortly. I would be remiss if I did not optimize everything I did. You can find me all over the internet on pretty much all the socials. It's fairly easy to find me. I used to have at the corner of search and social. You can probably still find me there. We have just recently closed our business, Truel Social Media, and I'm going to be concentrating solely on trying to save lives. And one of the things that I think is most important for people to understand, if you start what I call a conversation with someone, anyone, okay, talk to a stranger once a month. Yeah. I ask you, give them 10 minutes. Just listen. We have two ears. Just listen. And do that. You don't want to fix anything. Just give them the grace of listening to them.
And, you know, you're right. Just throwing a smile at somebody you don't know, saying hi to somebody you don't know. You don't know what kind of day they're having. You don't know if at that moment they've contemplated killing themselves because they feel nobody in the world cares about it. So even that little smile might even delay their decision for a while or maybe delay it enough where they realize that their life has value. So, and even just holding the door open for somebody, that has like a trickle-down effect.
Yeah,
I tell my students, just do that. Just wait and hold the door open for somebody and see the effect that doing that act of kindness has on somebody else.
And this is not just women, but very often, you know, you walk by somebody and you just think, oh, wow, that's beautiful. That hat, that coat, that shirt, that whatever. Don't keep it inside. Tell them.
No.
Tell that person. That may be the only good thing they hear all week.
Yeah.
You don't know what they're living through. And that gift you give them may buoy them up for a day, maybe more.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, okay, hope is so important. I want to map out hope for everybody. The fact is, I know for a fact there are people that have just recently released research, I believe it's 15 years, that hope is a teachable skill we can give everyone.
Absolutely.
And that is an incredible gift that people are giving. And they are now the Baton of Hope USA, and they are a foundation, the Foundation of Hope. And I'm telling tales out of school because we're all just sort of starting this part of it. But I firmly believe this is going to be a wave that overtakes a lot of the negativity in the world at the moment.
I think so. Hope, compassion, tolerance, the willingness to listen, those are going to be values that we can build the foundation of a new phase in our history, a new phase in our existence. And that's something that I hope and pray every day happens for us. And I think we're getting it. There's pockets of it, that movement that are going on. But I mean, it may be not in my lifetime, Elaine, but wherever I am, I'll look and say, yeah, this is what we were laying the seeds with. This is what you, me, and the other individuals who came down at this time were meant to do, is plant those seeds. And from wherever we are in the next the existence of our lives, my hope is we'll be able to see that come to fruition. So, but yeah. Wow, I could talk to you for about another 3 hours. just thanks so much, Elaine, for making time for me and my audience today. It was so wonderful talking with you. I know we're going to be talking again in the future. I don't think this will be the last of our conversation.
Not at all. And I want to say thank you to you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk to your audience. And to your audience, I want to say make the very best of your today, every day.
Thank you, Elaine. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.